welcome you to Doxodeo Hatfield, a multi-ethnic family on mission, passionate about Jesus, passionate about community, and passionate about serving the city of Tshwane.
My name is Joe. My wife was with me in the first service. We lead the team that leads Doxodeo Hatfield, and we're part of a bigger team of churches around the world and the city. But I'm thankful for your presence here this morning, because I'm trusting you're going to experience just who Jesus is and what his heart is for us. And I'm trusting that you would experience that on a deep level. So can I ask you, Doxodeo Hatfield, to open up a Bible with me to the book of 2 Samuel chapter 13. So 2 Samuel 13. While you're doing that, unless you are brand new with us, you would know that we've been, over the last many weeks, been going through this series called David, where we've been working through the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, looking at the life of David, but not with the intent to make much of David himself. We're not looking at him directly. We're looking at God at work in the life of David. Because David's not the hero. God is the one who brings truth and grace and justice into our lives. And so we learn about the nature of God and even our own lives as we look at the narrative of David. And today is the second last day of the series. Next week, we finish up as we've gone through his life. And today, we're looking at something of a heavy reality, the aftermath of the choices, the brokenness, the sin of David, as was so well explicated last week, I think, by Ulrich. And maybe just to catch us up a little bit. So last week, we saw this incredibly broken, sinful moment, this devastating failure by King David. So he's out on his palace roof one day, and he sees a woman. She's doing ritual bathing in the privacy of her own place. He sees her, and he wants her. He lusts after her. He has his people bring her to him, and he sleeps with her. He impregnates her. And then she's actually the wife of one of his soldiers currently fighting for him in his own army, Uriah. And so he brings this man back from the fighting. He tries to get him drunk a couple of times. He tries to have him sleep with his own wife so that he would cover his own backside. But Uriah is just too much of an honorable man to do this. And so in the end, shocking, shocking moment, David tells the commander of his army, Joab, to force Uriah when he goes back to the fighting to get him to the very front lines of the fight. And when he's at his most vulnerable, right at the front, retreat from him, abandon him. He has him murdered. Shocking moment. A man called, a man after my own heart, God says, and yet look at the brokenness and the sin that even he can fall into. And so God takes the first step and he confronts David through the prophet Nathan about his sin. And David is told the story by Nathan that is used to bring him to his senses, to show him you are the man of the story. And finally, there is a true moment of repentance and forgiveness for the shocking sin of David. But the question now is, so now what? What about the reverberations of this sin? If we just pick it up here in 2 Samuel 12, 13 for a moment, it says that David responded to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan replied to David, "The Lord has taken away your sin. You will not die." So there's genuine forgiveness here. But Nathan also tells him about the consequences, just the natural consequences of what's going to happen because of this. He says threefold. Number one, verse 10, "The sword will never leave your house, David. Secondly, I will take your wives and give them to another before your very eyes, and he will sleep with them in broad daylight." In verse 14, this is shocking. "The son born to you from this incident will die." Sectic stuff. And as I was reading this and trying just to comprehend what's happening here, just words that came to my heart, you know, words like fallout or consequences or, you know, the reverberations of this. But the word that really just gripped my heart was the word aftermath. What is the aftermath of an explosion of sin like this? So On the 26th of April, 1986, one of the most shocking events in human history, the reactor number 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant located near Pripyat in Ukraine exploded, something that was thought to be impossible. And there's a chilling scene that took place shortly after this explosion where a couple of kilometers away on the Pripyat Bridge, later would be renamed as the Bridge of Death, families started gathering because this reactor, as it exploded, you'll see it's a painting on the screen here of this, but as the reactor explodes, suddenly this almost mesmerizingly beautiful blue light started emanating from the reactor, pointing straight into the air. And, you know, these people were not aware of what's happening, so they start gathering with their families on this bridge to look at this beautiful light. If you've ever watched the HBO series about this event, it's chilling. And what they were not aware of in that moment, the fallout, the aftermath, is what was happening. The reason for this blue light was the radiation, the ionizing of the radiation, reacting with the air molecules. This was the cause of this seemingly beautiful blue light. What was actually happening, not only was it not pretty, it was deadly. They were being poisoned as they stood there. You see, that's on that day, in 1986, that reactor exploded in a moment, but the aftermath of it, the fallout of it, lasted for generations. Whole areas became uninhabitable as the radiation poisoned the land and the water, even the people. Friends, that is what sin does. The action might be just a moment, but the fallout, the aftermath, infects, poisons families, nations, cities, people. It takes a moment to explode, but sometimes the aftermath, the effects, they linger. And so the question is, what do we do with that? In these five chapters, chapters 13 to 18, we're going to see the shocking aftermath of David's evil actions. And though it's heavy, I want to invite you today to see that even maybe in your life or mine, when there are consequences, that painful things that linger in our lives, there is a powerful hope available to us. So let's work through it. We can't read every single verse, so we're going to do a bit of a high-level fly-through of these five chapters. And it begins in 2 Samuel 13. So David's firstborn, Amnon, he is the next in line for the throne. He's the heir to the throne. Something shocking happens. One of the most shocking scenes in the Old Testament. He is suddenly inflamed with lust toward his half-sister. So same dad, different mom. God condemns the polygamy that David just, you know, goes into. So he has this lustful, you know, drive toward her. He lures her to his bedroom. He tries to seduce her. And when that fails, he rapes her. It says here in verse 12, she cries out, "Don't, my brother," she cried, "don't disgrace me. Don't commit this outrage." But he refused to listen to her. And because he was stronger than she was, he disgraced her by raping her. And after this incident, the text says that he was so filled with rage toward himself and to her that he says, "Get this woman out of my sight." And listen to how he puts it here, verse 17. He says, "Put this woman out of my presence," and bolt the door after her. Now, do you remember how last week, how the sin of objectification toward a woman was part of the sin of David? He's on his roof. He's leering after, lusting after this innocent woman. And he, in exactly the same wording as you have with Amnon here, he says, "Who is this woman?" And the answer that comes back to him, it's almost like the writer is going out of his way to make the point. The answer comes back, "No, that's Bathsheba. She's the daughter of so-and-so. She's the wife of Uriah." It's almost like he's trying to say she's not just a body. She's a person. She has a name. She's someone's daughter. She's someone's wife. But to David, it didn't matter. She was just a body for his lust. It's exactly what pornography does to us today. As a generation, it teaches us to extract the humanity out of someone and use their body for our lust. But you see exactly Amnon using exactly the same language. He doesn't care who she is. He just uses her. So it says that, verse 18, Amnon's servants threw her out and bolted the door behind her. Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long-sleeved robe she was wearing. She put her hand on her head and went away crying out. And it says in verse 21, when King David heard about all these things, he was furious. Now that's the right reaction to have. But unfortunately, that's all that happens. He's angry, but he does nothing about it. He doesn't go to comfort Tamar, to take her into his home, to help her be restored and find healing. He doesn't go to confront his son about the evil in his heart and what he had done. Now, we don't know why he doesn't do anything. Maybe he feels too morally compromised himself because of what he had done, that he can't intervene. Maybe he, in his own mind, is too busy with kingly duties that he can intervene. Maybe he's just an absent father. We don't know. But the bottom line is, because of this passivity, we have a father and a king who's walking around so angry but doing nothing. And when I read that, I had such a caution in my heart. I'm asking myself, I'm asking you today, what are the things in my life, in my family, in my city, in our country that I'm walking around, I'm so angry about, but I'm not doing anything about it? We're in action. We see here the cycles, the generations, the fallout continues into the life of those around David. And so because of this passivity in David, the silence, one of his other sons, Absalom, he decides, I'm going to do something about this. And so he steps into the fray and he speaks to his sister. He's her full brother. And he says in verse 20, be quiet for now, my sister. He's your brother. Don't take this thing to heart. So Tamar lived as a desolate woman in the house of her brother Absalom. Now, that word desolate there means devastated. She was devastated. Her life got splintered in two because of this event. But you see how callous already Absalom speaks to her about this. Because he starts scheming for revenge. But the point is, the revenge was never about her. It was about him. It was about his selfish ambitions. So he hatches this two-year scheme we read in the text where he eventually lures Amnon, his brother, out of the kingdom, out of the city. He gets him drunk and he murders him. Now, just a note here, think about that for a second. What does that remind you of? Trying to get someone drunk, eventually murdering someone. Once again, the chains, the cycles, the sin, the fallout, just multiplying into the lives of David and his family. So if this were actually about Tamar, then Absalom would have acted very differently. If he wanted to see her restored and healed, his actions would have been so different. This was all about his ambition to be king. He wanted to get the next in line of the throne out of the way. And so he does this, and it's such a scandal that he flees the city and the kingdom. And for 2 years, he is banished. Him and his father never speak. It becomes this national scandal. And that's how this chapter then ends. So 2 Samuel 14 now. This woman comes to David, and she comes to tell him a story. Now, David doesn't realize, like last week, Nathan told them the story, and at the height of the story, and David is like, this is unjust. And she's like, yes, because you are that man, David. And once again, it's going to be one of these stories that he thinks is about someone else, but it's actually about him. She's been put up to tell him the story, and the story is supposedly about the two sons that she has. And these two sons, in one day of anger toward one another, the one in just this flaming rage kills the other son. And he's so ashamed, he flees the kingdom. But in his time away, he's experienced genuine repentance and he wants to come back, but the community has banished him. And I mean, David hears the story and he is indignant. He's like, this is crazy. Like, how? This is not right in my kingdom. You know, this banished son who's been away, the people don't want him back. This son must be restored. And once again, David, you know, it's like this lady is waiting for the punchline. Listen to what she says to him. Verse 13, David, why don't you do as much for the people of God as you have promised to do for me? You have convicted yourself in making this decision. Because you have refused to bring home your own banished son. And then listen to this little line she adds that I think is such a picture of what God would do in Jesus. She says, God does not just sweep life away. Instead, he devises ways to bring us back when we have been separated from him. It's powerful. But so David is caught once again. He's like, this is not right. And she's like, yes, because you are that man, David. And he's like, dang it, the second time. Like, fool me once, seriously. And he's like, okay, I relent. It's fine. Bring Absalom back into the kingdom. But still, David refuses to speak to Absalom. So more years pass where the two of them, he's in his kingdom now again, but he doesn't speak to his own son. All in all, 5 years of silence between the two of them. And so finally, in the ultimate moment of just, you know, throwing a bit of a hissy fit, Absalom sets fire to one of David's fields just so that his father would come out and engage him. You know, you think your kids act out with too much TV. It's like he literally sets fire to one of his fields. And finally, they have their conversation. And David has this whole very public, you know, ancient Eastern king. He kisses him publicly to restore him. But the two of them never actually reconcile. He doesn't actually engage his son on a heart level, so this anger still festers. And so for the next couple of years, Absalom starts scheming to actually take the whole kingdom from David. Now, in these chapters, we have to see a couple of things about Absalom. You'll read there that the first thing it says is that he was one of the tallest and most handsome men in the whole kingdom. Very interesting. It even goes out of its way, kind of comically, to make a comment about how luscious and beautiful his hair was. So, you know, all the ladies, like, he's tall, dark, handsome, long hair. He's got everything, this dude. But secondly, politically, he was cunning. So you'll see in chapter 15, he goes to the city gates on the way to his father's palace, and people will arrive to come and deal with issues they have with the king. And he'll kind of mosey up to them before they can get there. And he's like, oh, my friend, that's a challenging issue you've got there. You know, but, you know, dad, you know, the king, he's too busy at the moment to bring you justice. But just imagine if I were king, if I were judge, you would get justice. So he's cunning. And then thirdly is when these people realize eventually that they're speaking to Absalom, he's the son of the king. I mean, they like, this is ancient Eastern custom. They're bowing down before him. And he has this whole public like, oh no, brother, you know, pick them up. You know, don't bow down. You and I are the same, you know, the two of us. Which is so ironic because he is like the epitome of the trust fund baby who's, you know, become politician now, you know, has this whole I'm a man of the people kind of thing going on here. So it's kind of ludicrous, but all the scheming takes us to the result of all of that. 2 Samuel 15, verse 6. It says, so Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. It's taken him years, but he has systematically brought all the influence back from his father toward him. And then at the right moment, he launches this coup. And militarily, they come in and they chase away David and all of his people out of the palace, out of the kingdom, into the wilderness. And shocking moment, I keep using the word shocking because there's so many of them. In a shocking moment of to display his humiliation over his father, on the roof of the palace, he sets up this pavilion and he publicly, in view of the people of the kingdom, sleeps with some of David's wives. So in an honor shame culture like the ancient Near East, this is the ultimate humiliation. And listen to the state of humiliation. It says David is out in the wilderness, and it says here in chapter 15, verse 3 or 30, David was climbing the slope of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he ascended. His head was covered and he was walking barefoot. This is a man of authority, of power. He has been humiliated. So that's how chapter 15 then ends. So we can't read all of it, but if we now skip to chapter 18, this last moment, David has finally been able to muster and bring back enough of his own people, win over their hearts again, so that he can take back his kingdom from Absalom, his son. And so they have this battle, and as Absalom and his men realize they're losing, they're going to not win this fight, they flee out of the city and they flee into the wilderness. And as David's soldiers pursue Absalom, he says to them explicitly, 2 Samuel 18 verse 14, or 18 verse 5, he says, treat the young man Absalom gently for my sake. And so as Absalom flees, is on his horse, he goes into this deep brush. And then once again, just a crazy moment, we heard earlier about his thick, luscious hair, and his hair gets caught in this brush. And his horse kind of goes, and so he is, crazy moment, suspended in midair, absolutely helpless. And these soldiers just surround him. And one of the soldiers say, David said we not to touch this boy. But Joab, the commander of his army, says, no, that's ridiculous. This guy, we can't have him live. He will just do the same. He will scheme again. He will do all of this again. So 2 Samuel 18 verse 14, shocking moment. It says, so Joab, he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them into Absalom's chest. Now, David is awaiting news from this battle, and he's constantly asking everyone who comes, what's happened to Absalom? What's happened to my son? And then finally, someone has the guts to tell him what's happened. And the next verse, after he hears the news, is maybe one of the most heart-wrenching. If I just think about interpersonal, father, son, family, just relational moments, man, this is heavy. It says, 2 Samuel 18:33, the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber above the city gates, and he wept. And as he walked, he cried, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you, Absalom, my son, this is heavy. You know, in Hebrew language and writing, repetition is the way that you put like an exclamation mark, like capital letters onto something. And for the first time in all of these chapters, David uses the word son for Absalom. And not once or twice or 3 times, but 5 times he cries out, my son. It's like all the aftermath, all the fallout just dawns on him in this moment, overwhelms him, but it's too late. Because that is tragically how the story of David and his son Absalom ends. The aftermath lingers. Now, I want us to see today 3 things, just briefly, from this text that, as I say, I recognize this is heavy stuff. But we see in God 3 things here that brings hope to us. So the first, no surprise here, what we see in the text is that the aftermath of sin is real and far-reaching. It's real and far-reaching. When that reactor exploded on one fateful evening of 1986, the explosion took but a moment, but the fallout, the effects, lasted for almost now centuries. And the reality is what we see here with David is that the sin of jealousy and the sin of lust and the sin of selfish ambition and the sin of passive silence, it's as if those things multiplied out into the lives of his children. It's as if you realize my sin affects the people around me. Now, I want us for a moment just to consider the relationships that are close to you, that are dear to you, that you have interaction with. Because this affects all of these people. Maybe I can just use the frame of parent relationships for a second for it. Guys, I was shook just thinking about the fact that in these chapters, realizing as a parent, my sin affects the lives of my children. I'm not saying today that you are responsible for all the actions of the people close to you or your children, even their decisions. They still have to make their own decisions. What I'm saying is it affects them. If I am going to neglect my child consistently, there is a very good chance that they will grow up neglecting their own children. Children that grow up abused are statistically almost guaranteed to end up abusing themselves or others. If I have this workaholic just identity where the greatest thing I can do with my life is just financial security and, you know, performance in my career, I will gift my children
an identity crisis they will have to try and sort out later about their security and who they are and their significance. If my house is filled with gossip the whole time, it's gossip about the grandparents and about the friends at school and about, you know, about the colleagues, if that is, I am setting them up to have that be just the culture of our household going forward. I'm not saying we're responsible. I'm saying it affects them. You know, it's like when I was at school, we would sometimes have these train tours. We would go to other schools and other cities to go and play sport there. So you can imagine we have 1,000 boys on a train. Can you imagine the debauchery? It is wild. But something that struck me is you would be on this train for a day or two, and then after that, you come off of the train, and then suddenly you realize on your hands, in your ears, even you blow your nose, everywhere it's just soot. It's like the train, just in its presence, has infected you. That's what sin does. It affects the people around me. You know, my name is Johan. Everyone just calls me Joe. But I'm actually one of many Johans in my family. We are a long lineage of Johans. And you know, that comes with almost like this pride of, you know, this proud, you know, generations of Johans. But part of the issue with that is that virtually all the Johans that have preceded me have been deeply unfaithful to their wives. I remember being just listening into this heated conversation our family had when I was in high school, hearing them, and one of my aunts just in a heated moment just shouting out, like, you Strofeld men are all the same. In fact, when I was in primary school, there was a day that I walked in on my father busy cheating on my mom. Can I tell you, it affects you. The soot, it sits on you. And I've had to walk my own road with God. Say, God, is there a way for this to end in my generation? Now, I've realized it's tough when you see the idols that you wrestle with. What's an idol? It's when anything is more important to my satisfaction, my security, and even my significance than God. When idols, when I see them start manifesting in the people around me, even my children. I've shared with you before, you know, my parents had great success in business, and then in my first year at university, they go bankrupt. We lose everything. And I've come to realize over the last couple of years how that has made me so sensitive, overly sensitive to this issue of money. And I can be emotional about it and not, you know, think clearly about it. And it's tough when you see those things start manifesting in your children. Our sin, the aftermath, the consequences, it affects the lives of the people around us. And that's why it's so important. Secondly, here's the truth. Therefore, if the aftermath of sin is far-reaching, the aftermath of sin must be interrupted. It must be interrupted through surrender. The picture I don't want you to get today, please, is that almost of like dominoes. What happened with David is one domino, one mistake, one deep, grievous sin, and then it was all a mess. Then it's generations. It could never be broken. You know, on the 13th of November 2009 in the Netherlands, it was Domino Day, actually. They attempted to break the world record dominoes, you know, a team of 89 people for weeks setting up, get this, 4,491,863 dominoes. Can you imagine that? And then one domino and almost 5 million dominoes start going. I mean, I can't imagine even how long that took. I think that's the picture that we sometimes have. We see that and we think that's what's David, you know, in my own life. God, it's so tough that it was one decision, it was one issue, it was one moment, something that I did or something that was done to me, and now the dominoes just go, it can never be broken. Please, I don't want you to get that picture. What instead I want you to see is the picture of a chain, where at every single link of the chain, no matter how long and strong, at every single link, the link can be broken. Because that is who God is. He is the God who takes at any moment of that chain, if we allow him through his grace and his truth and his power, he comes to break the chains of generations. You don't have to, if you are a follower of Jesus here today, you don't have to live in the word spoken over you by your parents or those close to you. You don't have to. You know, people speak about bloodlines and things like this. I don't care for that. What I'm telling you is there are generational things that sometimes cycle through who we are. And God says, with you, it can stop. I can break it. That's what he does. That's who he is. Because the reality is, we see here that Amnon was not willing to break the cycle of lust. And Absalom was not willing to break the cycle of selfish leadership. But I think most consequential for them is David was not willing to break the cycle of silence and apathy. Can you just imagine how different this would have played off if David, instead of apathy and silence, stepped in and he engaged Tamar and brought her into his home? He worked toward justice for her and healing for her. If he engaged his sons, if he stepped in as father, can you imagine how different it would have been? But what was this? Silence, apathy. The Christian psychologist Larry Crabbe has this old book called The Silence of Adam. And he makes the case that he says it's almost like, you know, part of the original sin that kind of sits at the heart of every human being, irrespective of your background in religion or faith. He says part of what sits there, speaking about Adam and Eve, he says it is this idea of apathy and silence, inaction. You know, sins of commission are the things that we do that we shouldn't, but sins of omission are the things that we don't do when we should. And he says, you know what? Adam was there. The text says he was right there, end quote, as this moment of temptation happens. And what did he do? Nothing. Silence, apathy. And it hit me hard last week when Ulrich, we were just reading through this text together as a church. And at the end of all of this brokenness with David and Bathsheba and all of this, the murder, it says this at the very end of that whole passage. 2 Samuel 11:27. But the Lord considered what David had done to be evil. That rocked me. And I just thought, what in my life at the moment, what in my family at the moment, what in my city or my country at the moment is God saying, this is evil. But I am standing by idle. Apathy, silence. That's why Edmund Burke so famously said, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men and women, what? To do nothing. Now, in these chapters, we have David, the silent king, who should have spoken out. We have Amnon, the cruel king, who should have used his power to protect. We have Absalom, the selfish king, who should have served humbly. It's as if all these chapters are crying out as you read them and say, we need a true and better king. We need a true and better Adam. We need a true and better human. And that is why it is so powerful that is exactly where the Bible takes us. Because if it's true that the aftermath of sin is far-reaching, friends, hear me today when I tell you that in Jesus, the cross of Jesus unleashed an even greater aftermath. An even greater aftermath. Don't miss this detail. When David is humiliated and he's walking in the wilderness, it says the following. Just read this again. Verse 30 says, David was climbing the slope of the Mount of Olives. And he's crying, he's weeping, he's broken. Now, what's powerful is about 1,000 years later, those very same gardens and brushes and greenery that he would have had to walk through to get onto those slopes, in that very same spot on the slope of the Mount of Olives, there is now a garden renamed the Garden of Gethsemane. And there is now another son of David who is weeping and wrestling and sweating blood. Because he has been brought to that place, not because of his own sin, like David going into that place, but he's been brought there because of our sin. God stepping into the aftermath of human brokenness and depravity, stepping into the human story in the person of Jesus, the Son of Suffering, as we spoke about this morning, he comes. And he comes not to on the cross and in his resurrection, in his victory, to not simply deal with the penalty of sin and Satan and death, but he comes to deal with the power of sin over your life. He comes to say, Sarah said it in the first service so beautifully, he doesn't call you to be the chain breaker. He says, I come to break the chains. I come to break the chains, even of generations over your life. I come to be the true and better king. I come to be the true and better Adam. I come to be the true and better human. In me, not only is the penalty dealt with, but the power is broken. You don't have to live in the aftermath of sin. That's why it's so powerful for me. Hebrews 10:14 speaks of the victory of Jesus, the cross of Jesus, and it says, for by a single offering. He said aftermath is it's the after effect of a significant event. There has never cosmically been a greater, more significant event than the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. And it says, by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. He's saying, yes, we are all being, if you're a Christian here today, you are being grown in your character. It's a lifelong journey. But if you trust in Jesus, believe in Jesus, then it says your position before God, your status before God, he has made you in his sacrifice perfect. This is where the cycles, the generations, the chains are broken, right here. I love Eugene Peterson, his paraphrase of this verse. It says, it was a perfect sacrifice by a perfect person to perfect some very imperfect people. And this, friends, this is good news. Not just because of the David in all of us that need to have the chains of generations broken in our time, but because of the Tamar in all of us as well. Because of the sin not committed, but the sin done to you, to me. The abuse and the brokenness and the backstabbing. Jesus says, I come to deal with, I come to heal, I come to restore. That's why the prophet Isaiah, he looks forward many generations and he sees a picture of the Jewish Messiah to come. We now know this is Jesus. And he says of what he would do, he says, Jesus, yet he himself bore our sickness on the cross. He carried our pains. It says at the end there, he heals us by his wounds. This is the God who says, come to me. And so friends, here's the reality that on that day in 1986, it took a moment for that reactor to explode. But the after effect, the aftermath, the fallout has gone so far and wide. But if it's true that the aftermath is something that lingers because of a significant event, can I tell you, it pales in comparison to the explosion of grace and truth that happened in Jesus. And the aftermath of his resurrection reverberates into every heart and every city and every square millimeter of the universe calling out, come to me. And here's the reality, friends. You are either, every single heart, every person, every generation is going to have to live in one of these two aftermaths. Am I going to live in the aftermath of sin or of Jesus? Because the aftermath of sin is shame and separation and cycles of hurt and generational wounds. But the aftermath of Jesus is freedom and reconciliation, new beginnings, a restored identity. Yes, the effect of the explosion, of it's great, but Paul, in fact, Romans 5, I love this. He writes to the church in Rome and he says, you know, the difference between the grace we have in God and sin, he begins by saying the gift of grace, it's not like the trespass. It's not like the sin. Yes, the sin, the explosion is great. But then he goes on and he says, for if by one man's trespass the many died, how much more? It's the grace of God and the gift which comes through the grace of this one man, overflowed to the many. How much more will those who receive this overflow of grace and this gift of righteousness reign in life in the man Jesus Christ? Yes, the aftermath of sin is great, but how much more will the aftermath of Jesus echo into all parts of the world? And the question is, where will you live? In the aftermath of what will your identity be found? You know, this isn't closing. Hillsong United, many years ago, they had this beautiful song called Aftermath. And they say, in a moment of glorious surrender, you were broken for all the world to see. Lifted out of the ashes, I am found in the aftermath. In that moment of glorious surrender, it was the moment that you broke the chains in me. Lifted out of the ashes, I am found in the aftermath. Let's pray. Jesus, I pray today that the overflow, the how much more of your grace would come and restore and redeem and rewrite, would interrupt old stories, God. And may we find ourselves today in you. And I pray specifically for any person who has yet to experience that forgiveness, that grace, who hasn't come to you, Jesus, as Lord and Savior. May they do that today. May they pray to you today. May they receive your grace today. Teach us to live in the aftermath of your grace, Jesus. Amen.